This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
One of the most commonly overlooked facts is that wine grapes use much less water than a lot of other irrigated crops
right.
do. So if you're growing alfalfa, for example, or other crops that use more water in a typical growing season, taking 1 acre of that crop out, you might be able to replace that amount of water with several acres of wine grapes.
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world from our Atascadero Wine Cellar studio in the heart of the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California, we bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow, talk to me nice.
And it is time for your weekly Grape Encounter. And I'll tell you what, this week, I hate to say it, but we're not going to be in as much of a party mood as we normally are on Grape Encounters Radio, because I'm really concerned, and you should be concerned too, because the stories that I'm reading and the things that I'm seeing about the drought in about half of America is really, really scary stuff. It is frightening when you consider that some of the gigantic lakes and reservoirs that supply water, for instance, to Southern California are in some cases at, you know, maybe a third of their normal capacity. And on top of that, I don't know if you heard the story the other day, but a water main broke in Los Angeles near UCLA, wiped out a few buildings, 20 million gallons of water. Shame on you, Los Angeles. That's careless. That water is very precious. We need it to grow grapes. Well, if you're on the East Coast, you probably are not too terribly concerned about this story. But remember, California produces 90% of the wine that's consumed in America. That's a lot. So when you consider that, it can have a huge impact on what you drink later on. It's probably good news for the folks up in New York and places like Virginia that make some very good wines and don't have the water problems that exist out on the West Coast. So we're going to get into that a little bit later. We have a very special guest coming on who is really an expert on all things wine and how wineries can actually conserve a great deal of water. But I thought we have to at least have a little fun here. And I will tell you, last night I was at an event. And I came across a product that astounded me. What I was going to be doing the first segment here of Grape Encounters was I was going to talk to you about things that you can add to your wine that are perfectly acceptable. And this is all a subject that came up when I opened up a bottle of wine the other day and my wife and I were drinking it. And it was dreadful, honestly. It was a Petit Verdot. And the absence of fruit in this wine was very scary. And I did something that I normally never advise anybody to do. I'll tell you about it in a second. But back to the product that I ran into, because we're going to have with us a guest here for a little while. And I thought I would talk about the things you can add to wine with her. But I want to first talk about the product that she's making, because it is really amazing. Rosemary Hawthorne runs Bless Your Heart Baking, which makes gluten-free, low glycemic, and allergen-free baked goods. You know, when people hear that, they go, yuck. Yeah, sure. I want the gluten. You make a product that I tried yesterday. And when you tell people about this product and what's in it, do they just go, what?
Yes. Most people have a hard time believing it.
I did. And then I got addicted and you were giving out samples. Then I came back and got some more samples. And I was just freaking out at how good this was.
We've been told there should be a warning label about addiction on it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So obviously it's wine related. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about it on Grape Encounters Radio. But Rosemary Hawthorne, Bless Your Heart Baking. Tell them what it is.
We make a gluten-free cracker that's also organic and vegan, but we make it with grape seed flour. It's called the Drunken Diva, made with Chardonnay grape seed flour. So that buttery flavor of the Chardonnay wine comes through in the cracker and it's just delicious.
So I don't get this. The seeds that come from the grapes that wine is made from are generally just mulched or thrown away, right?
A lot of times fed to cattle, yes. They get the grape juice out of, and then they get the grape seed oil. And then it's usually just thrown into garbage or mulch or for cattle.
That's it.
But there's so much resveratrol and antioxidants, more than in wine, right in the seed. That's the base.
So where do you get your seeds? Or do you just buy the flour?
I buy the flour, yes.
This is so off my radar. Mm-hmm. I had no idea it even existed. Grape seed flour.
Well, when you're doing gluten-free, since you're taking out traditional flours, you're always looking for other things that will work to make that flour-like texture. So we try a lot of different things that might not be in a typical baked good, like organic beans and things like that.
But so much of the gluten-free stuff is just, I'm sorry, it's not very good.
That's very true. And so much of it has additional sugar to make it taste good. And I'm also diabetic, so I have to really watch the glycemic index of everything. So that has been my goal.
That was the impetus for creating
Absolutely.
The company. So is grapeseed flour readily available?
No, there's not a lot of places that make the grapeseed flour.
I'm blowing off this radio stuff, and I'm going into the grapeseed flour business.
It's catching on. People are beginning. There are a few places that mill it. And you can mill it yourself, too. But it's
will it rise?
It does, but it has a stickier flavor, so you have to combine it with other flours.
Yeah, so you can't just put grapeseed flour in.
No, I make some wine cookie coolers. I call them the wine cooler cookies. And we use Riesling, the Chardonnay. Merlot brownie is wonderful to add to a brownie mix. It just really makes it rich because, you know, if you can picture pairing Merlot with a brownie and chocolate, they're perfect together. So we try and pair the same way you would pair a wine.
All right.
Food.
So we're going to be talking a lot about sustainability, especially as it pertains to wine on this show. But I just thought that this was such a great story because, you know, here you've got these seeds that in many cases are just going to waste. And now that I have experienced how good a product can be made out of grape seeds and their resveratrol content. I mean, we're talking about a compound that we know has like a multitude of health benefits. I want to see all of those seeds turn into flour immediately. So wine people, don't feed them to the cows. I wanted to talk a little bit about the things that you can add to wine and not feel guilty about. Let me tell you what happened, okay? So we opened up a bottle of Petit Verdot, and this wine was dead. It was so blah and kind of sour, and I was trying to think, what am I going to do with this wine? I can't drink this. Then in sort of a last-ditch effort to find a use for it, I went and grabbed a sugar bowl. I added just a touch of sugar to the wine. I stirred it in, and I tasted it, and I looked at my wife, and I said, much better.
You could have done fruit. You could have pureed fruit.
Yeah, I could have. And by the way, that's one of the other things that you can add to wine and not feel guilty about it is fruit. When in doubt, when you've got a bad wine, I'm not talking about a bad wine, meaning that the wine is turned, but it doesn't taste that great. First thing you should do is make sangria. Chop up all the fruit you got in the house and put it in a bowl. There are no rules where sangria is concerned, but you just add the wine and the fruit will take care of covering up the mistakes of the winemaker. But you can add sugar. And it was really funny because I went online and I started looking to see if any of the really credible wine publications would condone or look down upon this practice. And it turns out that one of the more popular publications, because somebody had written in and they said, it's probably okay, but next time, if you like wine a little sweeter, just buy a sweeter wine. I agree, but it's your wine. You paid for it. You can do whatever you want with it. Now, the second thing that you can add to wine, and I recommend this a lot. I'm going to tell you, it's so amazing what this particular ingredient will do to wine, especially wine that's really high in alcohol. If you've got a wine that's up there in the 15 plus category, a teaspoon of, what do you think, Rosemary?
Cinnamon?
No, don't ever add cinnamon to wine. Well, that's mulled wine. No, water.
Oh, really?
Let me make it very clear to all who are listening that winemakers add water to wine all the time. They do that to bring down the alcohol, and it's not going to water down your wine. It's just the opposite. Here's a very interesting factoid that is going to make you look very smart at your next party. Alcohol tends to cling to the flavor molecules in wine and vice versa. They're attracted to each other. So they hook up at a little party in your glass. And when you add water and tone down the alcohol, it actually releases those flavor molecules. So instead of the wine tasting watered down, it's just the opposite. Some of the flavor comes through and the wine tastes a lot smoother and better. It brings the alcohol down just a little bit. This is a practice that people are starting to catch on to.
If I bought a bottle of wine, I'd turn it into a strawberry margarita.
And absolutely, I'll tell you what, most wines can be used to make cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, white wines can be used to make margaritas, mojitos. We do it all the time at home. It's perfectly okay. Last thing that I'm actually caving on this one, and it's the addition of ice to your wine. It makes my skin crawl when somebody says, can I have a couple ice cubes to do this? But in Europe especially, they do that a lot. They'll chill a red wine with ice cubes. And what's it doing? The ice cube is kind of
adding the water,
bringing out the flavor, chilling down the wine a bit. I think we tend to drink our red wines a little too warm. Just a little bit of chill isn't a bad idea. Rosemary, it was fun having you on. You know what? I thought I knew everything that was out there, and this was a great discovery. I really love this.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
I really love it. It's Bless Your Heart Baking, and you can go online to blessyourheartbaking.com, and you can order this product all over the world. Coming up next, we have our expert on all things water and how we can keep on growing great grapes and making beautiful wines in the face of a terrible drought that is doing a whole lot of damage. And also stay with me because Wilfred Wong from wine.com joining us in just a little bit with a little wisdom from Wilfred.
Imagine four fabulous days celebrating the delights of food and wine. That's Sunset Savor the Central Coast coming to San Luis Obispo County. Sip more than 200 wines. Indulge in culinary bites from over 30 local chefs. Meet winemakers, brewmasters, and artisans. Discover the latest trends in food and wine from the experts at Sunset Magazine. Visit SavorCentralCoast.com. San Luis Obispo County. Pure playtime.
Your Savor the Central Coast adventure begins September 25th.
As the host of a wine show based on the Central Coast of California, a lot of visiting friends and listeners ask me for suggestions about places to visit in this neck of the woods. Well, one place that is always on that list is Hammersky Vineyard and Tasting Room, just 15 minutes northwest of Templeton on Vineyard Drive. From the beautiful New England barn to the charming historic farmhouse to the warm and inviting tasting room that sits on a knoll overlooking one of the region's most breathtaking views, Hammersky is a must-visit destination. Hammersky features an outstanding selection of handcrafted wines that are a true reflection of its rare and beautiful setting. Enchanting, sexy, sophisticated, but very approachable. See what I mean online at hammersky.com. Then plan a trip to one of the crown jewels of the Central Coast, Hammersky Vineyards. It deserves to be on your bucket list.
As a grape encounterist, you know how much fun an hour of conversation about wine can be each week. But there's no way we can pack everything into a show. Listeners just like you are turning the Grape Encounters Radio Facebook group into an incredible online community where like-minded wine lovers converse, share information, and inspire each other with posts on a variety of interesting topics. If you haven't discovered your community, join in today on Facebook by entering Grape Encounters Radio.
He's setting down the wine glass and picking up the microphone. Here's your Grape Encounters host, David Wilson.
But I'm in a drought, but I'm in a drought.
Okay, back with Grape Encounters Radio. And, you know, I like to generally talk about happy subjects on this show. We are the lighthearted, don't take yourself too seriously wine show. But I have been reading way too much material on what is going on as far as water is concerned, not just in the state of California, but all over the country, probably at least 50% of the country now suffering from mild to very severe drought conditions. And when you start looking at photographs of some of the major reservoirs and rivers and lakes that used to be great for fishing and used to be the water supply for not just people who had lawns in their front yard, but vineyards that needed the water for irrigation, you start to realize just how scary the situation is. I know sometimes that we talk a bit much for some people's taste about California, but it's important to realize that California produces 90% of the total U.S. wine production. That's a lot. And then when you take into consideration on the West, the neighbors of California, like Washington and Oregon, and even states now like Idaho, Arizona, Texas, a big wine producer, all the way out West, you've got a lot of grapes being grown, a lot of wine being made, and the drought affects everybody. So having said that, I was so pleased that we were able to get a hold of Fritz Westover, who is not just a viticulturist, but the technical program manager for an organization called the Vineyard Team. They are renowned because they assist vineyards in a number of different ways, but maybe the most important is to manage their water wisely and to be sustainable. Fritz, you have got to be busier than you've ever been in your life right now with this particular situation.
Well, yes, David, actually, this has been taking up, I would say, the majority of the time that I spend in doing education, outreach, and research programs with the Vineyard Team. And coming from another state like Texas, where I worked before, you know, we would have drought occasionally. In 2011, it was a pretty big drought. But recently, when I moved here, this is the topic every year, not just in 2011 or in a few years. So most of the programs we're working on have been focusing on water conservation technologies for using water better, and also for managing and monitoring water use. So that's not something new to the Vineyard Team. The Vineyard Team has been around since the 90s, and we've been working on water-related programs since then. And it's now obviously a little bit more emphasized in the media and also in what we're writing grants for, getting projects on the ground and in growers' vineyards in relation to. So
no, drought is certainly not new to California, but one of the things that I think is new to California is the ever-increasing production levels of wine, because I'm looking at a chart right here that goes back to 1995 from the Wine Institute. And back in 1995, the California production was 397 million gallons of wine. Today, or at least in 2012, I think that was their latest figure, it was 662. So I'm guessing that by now it's pretty close to double what it was just back in 1995. That requires a lot of land and a lot of water for the purposes of making wine. And we know that in every state, whether it's Washington, Oregon, Idaho's got a big wine industry that's starting to just blossom right now. Texas is really going at it in a big way. Go Texan. We're seeing everybody getting into the wine game, and it doesn't matter how much wine we produce, we're drinking it. It is a big consideration and potentially has the ability to suck up a lot of water, or does it?
Well, I think one of the most commonly overlooked facts is that wine grapes use much less water than a lot of other irrigated crops
right.
do. So if you're growing alfalfa, for example, or other crops that use more water in a typical growing season, taking 1 acre of that crop out, you might be able to replace that amount of water with several acres of wine grape. Obviously, there are more acres of vineyard going into the ground, and they do require irrigation in a lot of sites. There are some sites that are fortunate enough to get enough water in the wintertime and the dormant season to dry farm, but those represent a smaller percentage of the vineyards.
So take us across the country for a second, because you have had a lot of experience in both Virginia and Texas and California. And Virginia, I have to imagine, is a very different story than out West, right? It actually rains there in the summertime.
Right. So I first started as a viticulturist in Virginia with the Extension Service there for Virginia Tech. And one of the biggest projects we worked on while I was there was actually growing cover crops underneath the vines to remove water from the ground, because we had rainfall during the growing season.
Oh, no kidding. So they would actually plant other types of vegetation to suck up the water so that the grapes did not get overwatered.
Exactly. Because here,
how about that?
It rains in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And then you can control the growth during the season with your irrigation. But one of the things that we would do in the East is, if you get 6, 7, 10, 14 inches of rain during the growing season, and usually at the worst time, you want to find a way to try and evaporate that water and get it out of the system before it causes too much vegetative growth and shading on the fruit. So yeah, it was really an opposite type of issue. And it's not that there aren't drought seasons occasionally, but dry farming was more the norm. Irrigation was used in maybe 50% of the vineyards as they were developing 10, 15
years ago. So completely different story there. It's how do you get water off the crops? And here it's how do you get water onto the crops? Let's go from Virginia to Texas for a moment. Quite often, I think in Texas, they have a lot of crop destruction from hailstorms in the middle middle of the summertime, right?
Yeah. In fact, they're working on projects out in western Texas where they're netting using a type of bird netting just for hail. So yes, I would say Texas is probably one of the most challenging places to grow grapes in terms of having just about every fungal disease in the soil and on the foliage that is possible. And then you add hail.
But they're going at it with a passion anyway.
Oh, yes. There's no stopping wine production all across the United States.
Okay, we'll return and we'll talk about how do you fix the problem when we continue with Grape Encounters Radio. My guest, Fritz Westover, viticulturist and technical program manager for the Vineyard team. Stay with me.
Connecting winemakers, wine lovers, wine adventures, and all things wine from around the globe. You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson.
Playtime. It's one of the world's most precious commodities, and it's time to play in San Luis Obispo County. Midway between Los Angeles and San Francisco, San Luis Obispo County, featuring wine country, beautiful coastline, and home to Hearst Castle, has captured the hearts and captivated the minds of visitors. From its breathtaking 80 miles of coastline, offering 315 days of sunshine, thriving marine life, and decadent seafood, to its world-class wine country featuring handcrafted vintages, farm-to-table cuisine, and exceptional hospitality, San Luis Obispo County is the place visitors come to indulge and focus on pure play. San Luis Obispo County takes you back to the Western lifestyle. Enjoy this California destination wine tasting, kayaking, cycling, hiking, or simply take in the sweeping views. Playtime is precious, so make every minute matter. Plan your Pure Play getaway online at visitsanluisobispocounty.com. Then visit San Luis Obispo County.
Just where is wine country? At Grape Encounters, we know it's coast to coast and continent to continent. Our microphones have traveled far and wide on vino train trips, across a vineyard via zipline, into the castles of American aristocracy, to the midway at a county fair, into the kitchens of chefs whose culinary artistry is inspired by wine, and front and center for extraordinary tastings and pairings. Where will we go next? We're on the lookout for events, businesses, and people that embody the spirit of Grape Encounters Radio. Share your suggestions. If you know of a great place or event that we should broadcast from, or have a business or guest idea, we want to hear about it. Grape Encounters can deliver national awareness, and we're as close as an email away. Drop us a line. Write to David at GrapeEncountersRadio.com. That's David at GrapeEncountersRadio.com.
And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues from our Central Coast San Luis Obispo County Wine Country Studio in Atascadero, California.
When the earth is parched and dry, you'd have to be insane to argue with the fact that we could use a little rain. We need the rain.
I remember that little poem, water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. That really is the case out on the west coast of the United States. You may have a great big Pacific Ocean out there, but there was an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times that made the point that if you think that something like desalinization is going to solve the water problems, forget about it. Anyway, that op-ed by Jay Famiglietti, he's the senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. But now returning with us is Fritz Westover, who is the technical program manager at the Vineyard team. And I'm guessing right now, Fritz, with a drought that's literally covering half of the United States and a very concerned grape growing community, that you guys are probably busier than you would probably have ever been before.
I think we've always been busy on a lot of topics, but water's taking up more and more of that time that we're spending on education outreach. We've been doing some grant writing and getting some programs in place, working with USDA Conservation Innovation Grants on getting devices such as soil moisture sensors and plant stress data from vineyards so we could use that as an example to show growers how they can better manage their water. And I think that's the biggest thing. If you can work with growers, whether they be new growers or growers who are experienced and that technology is new to them, to kind of get through that learning curve so that that grower understands the technology, sees how they're watering, where the water is going, how deep it percolates into the soil, and when the greatest demand for water is by the plant in the season, they can then use their judgment and use that feedback from these tools to make sure they're not overwatering, obviously. And then if they want to impose a little bit of stress and improve wine quality, they could also use those tools for that.
So let's talk about that stress for a second, because one of the things that I think is counterintuitive for most people is that a stressed plant is not a good thing. And, you know, sometimes you'll hear about the production volume that comes from a particular vineyard. And when somebody says they're getting 10 tons per acre versus 3 tons per acre, you want to say, wow, that's great. You're going to make a lot of wine with that, but that's not going to be the best wine.
There is the idea that a lower yield can make a better wine quality, but there's a certain point where you're going underneath what you potentially could crop.
So what is the threshold? I mean, because we hear about how grape plants like to be stressed, and much of the time that's exactly what we do to them. We put them under a little stress and they perform a little bit better, just like you and me.
Right, right.
But there's got to be a threshold where it's starting to get a little ugly for that plant and it starts to affect the root system and things like that. What happens when a grape plant has too much deprivation?
Well, the whole idea with stress in grapevines is there is that general idea that a stressed vine makes a good wine. I believe that a plant that is under a little stress during some times of the season can be good. If you're trying to control berry size and you want to impose a little stress while the berries are developing to do that, that's fine. But if you don't achieve a certain canopy length or shoot length and number of leaves to ripen the fruit that you have in the vine, then that would be a problem. And likewise, you could stress vines whether they're cropped at, let's say, that 3 tons per acre that you mentioned, or you could stress vines at 10 tons per acre. It just depends on how much stress you allow, typically through the water that you apply. Most growers will apply stress at strategic times of the season to get a little bit of slowdown on the shoot tip growth once they've developed their canopy, or to try to hone in on the fruit size or berry size that they want. But you're going to hear a lot of different opinions from the grower and a lot of different philosophies. But in general, the vine needs to complete its life cycle. It needs to produce ripe fruit that animals would like to eat or humans would like to make into wine. It needs to develop a mature seed with a seed coat on it, and it takes a certain amount of time to do that. And if you impose too much stress, you may not achieve that goal, so you wouldn't be able to achieve good quality wine or finish the life cycle of the vine and its reproduction cycle. So that's really the nutshell.
How far can a grape plant's roots go down?
That is subject to many, many different opinions, but it typically depends on where the barrier is in the soil. If there's air and water 20 feet down in the soil, the roots can tap into that and survive there. Some vineyards may be very shallow rooted, you know, 2 or 3 feet at the most, and others can get down to 10 or 15. In an irrigated vineyard, typically the most active root system is going to be closer to the surface where it's obtaining water.
So when you experience drought conditions, do the grape plants reach deeper for water, or is it just the opposite?
Well, it's funny you should say this. We just had a great program, one of our tailgate meetings, on vine stress and on roots and rootstocks and on dry farming. It was a combination meeting. And we had a researcher come from UC Davis and talk about rootstocks and how the different types of rootstocks you can graft your variety onto. Because, of course, if you're growing Cabernet Sauvignon, you could attach that to many different types of rootstocks. And they all have numbers and names associated with them and different genetics. And they're all from American rootstocks. So they're basically a native grape to this area, right, or somewhere in the country. And they all grow differently. Some will naturally genetically grow shallow, like a riparian rootstock that grew near a stream or a riverbank. Others will grow more deeply that come from arid regions, like a Berlandieri is another variety that is known for growing on chalky soils or calcium-rich soils and growing more deeply. So a grower could actually choose a rootstock that would grow a little bit more deeply. And so the genetics are part of that. And then we could probably say that how the vineyard is watered might affect where the majority of the roots are as well, or where the vine draws water from. There's a few factors involved with that. It's never a black and white, straightforward answer. That's why I love being in viticulture. You always learn something new, and everywhere you put in a new vineyard, there's a new lesson to be learned from that.
So if you were to read the trades and actually just read the major newspapers throughout the Western U.S., and I hear a lot of people talking about it even on the East Coast, because when I talk to somebody that's back East, they'll often say, hey, how's that drought going out there? So it's making news all over, I guess, the world. There is a certain amount of panic that goes on. Do the winemakers who've been in the business for a really long time find these drought conditions to be something that they can deal with very calmly? Or are you seeing any panic from them as well?
I don't think that I would say I'm seeing panic. I think there's a definite concern by both the grape growing community and the winemakers because they want this to be a sustainable production. We want to have grapes coming from a vineyard 1 year and then from that same vineyard 5 years down the line. So yes, there's a concern for that vineyard from both the winemaker and grape grower perspective.
Now, a lot of new people have come into the winemaking business, and there are plenty of those out there that have only been in for a matter of a few years, and maybe they're just getting their first crops now. I've got to imagine they're probably more concerned at this point in time saying, what in the world did I get into?
Well, certainly it's a tough time to enter the market when there's a lot of concerns with drought. There's a lot of concerns about whether or not we're going to pull out of this cycle. And sure, yeah, it's not exactly the honeymoon years for grape growing, if you want to put it that way. But you know, if you think about the whole cycle of the vineyard industry, it always comes in bubbles and bursts and then declines. And there's that type of general trend, even in the absence of a drought. I think what it's forcing some growers to do is to look at some of their older blocks or blocks that are less productive and maybe consider, is it worth it to take that block out of production? Maybe we want to conserve some water by taking this one out, wait a while before we decide to put it back in, or redesign the block and put it back in using more water conservation practices, maybe using irrigation system that's more efficient, maybe planting the vines on a spacing that's more water efficient, a rootstock that uses less water or is able to grow deeper and mine water from deeper in the soil. So I think as we see replanting going on and more modern vineyards planted, I think most people will have water conservation in mind going into that.
How scientific does it get these days? Because I've read stories about vineyards that have sensors literally on the plants that are monitoring the moisture content of the plant and then controlling the irrigation.
First of all, the cost of all these technologies is something that is a barrier for adoption. The lack of experience using some of these technologies. So let's say you want to monitor vine stress. You could look at the water potential in the leaf by putting a leaf, plucking it from the vine, putting it in a pressure chamber, adding pressure to the chamber, and seeing how much pressure is required to get the sap to flow. You could look at vine stress with a sap meter or sap flow sensor that actually is inserted into the vine to look at water movement in the vine. You could look at weather data to predict how much the crop is transpiring and how much water loss there is into the atmosphere. There are a lot of tools out there already. What we're trying to do is bring the information to a grower in a form where they can easily see how the information is useful. We teach by example. We're working with growers who are new to these technologies and showing how their behavior on how they water has changed based on the use of these technologies. So they know how much vine stress they can achieve before they need to water. They're not guessing anymore by just looking at the vine, but yeah, they can look at the actual measurements coming from the vine. They could look at the soil moisture levels in the soil with a soil moisture sensor, and they can combine that with the weather data and really see the whole picture.
What is the amount of improvement when you take a vineyard or a grape grower who's had an unlimited source of water and now is faced with serious drought conditions and mandatory restrictions on water usage? How much improvement can you actually obtain in a typical situation?
Well, it's hard to measure, and that's one of the things that I'm hoping we'll be able to try to put some numbers to. And of course, every season's different. If you get more rainfall going into the season, you have more stored soil moisture that you can draw from. So you'll irrigate either starting later in the year or less in general. So
I was hoping you were going to say, well, we can improve it by 50%.
Well, in some sites—
Nothing's quite this easy, right?
Yeah. Right. In some sites, maybe you could. And it depends on, like I said, what your conditions are in the season and what your yield objectives are and everything else. But I think if you can follow your soil moisture, you can follow your plant stress, you could follow the weather data and decide based on that and develop a system that works that your vines don't crash and fall off the edge of the cliff from too much stress, but you're not giving them a luxurious amount of water or watering past the root zone that's going to pick up the water, then you could find that balance in between, still have a sustainable vineyard or a crop that you have every year, and know that you're not using an excessive amount of water. We like to take the guesswork out by using these technologies. technologies and looking at the actual measurements, but there still has to be someone in the vineyard looking at the vines, touching the leaves, and looking at the shoot tips, because I don't think we're going to replace that with any technology. I think it's still going to be a tool, just another tool that growers use.
I'm actually glad to hear that. Technology does take a lot of fun out of the whole mix, but I do think it's very important. And, you know, when we hear stories right now about tracts of land that are literally sinking because too much water is being extracted out of that land, from every aspect of water usage, certainly in the western part of the U.S., we've got to be much more vigilant.
The thing about it is water use is not just from one agricultural commodity. It's from many. It's also from communities. There are many people using water. And I think that farmers in general want to be able to demonstrate that they're using water responsibly. So the more ways that they can show that, the better it's going to be for how they interact with their local community, for what they're going to actually have as their bottom line for water use for the year. Because growers don't want to waste water. Farmers don't want to waste water. Nobody wants to. And I think that if you have some kind of measures and standards and bases to go by, whether it be weather data, soil data, plant data, something to show that you're just not putting out more than you need to, that's going to be what most farmers are hoping to show in general, that we're good stewards of the land. We're using water as much as we need to for this crop, but nothing more, hopefully, is the idea.
I really appreciate you coming in. And we're going to tap you periodically to just talk about this. And, you know, maybe we can actually go out into a vineyard and you can show us what physically is being done to help these vineyards become more sustainable.
Sure. You know, we have a few projects we're working on with irrigation demonstrations using different soil sensors and plant stress sensors in vineyards. And we're also doing some cover crop work this year from a Western Sustainable Agriculture and Research Education grant to look at cover crop species that use less water or ways to terminate a cover crop in order to conserve water for the vineyard. And these are all projects that we'd welcome you to come out and take a look at.
Very awesome. And if somebody wants to learn more about the Vineyard team, you've got a great website, right? So
we do. And all of our projects that are related to water conservation are listed on there. It's vineyardteam.org.
A very educational segment, and I really appreciate it, Fritz, you're being in here, because I think it's probably one of the least understood aspects of winemaking on the part of the consumer.
David, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me and letting the Vineyard team represent some of the things we're doing in the area in conservation.
All right, we'll be back with more Grape Encounters Radio and Wilfred Wong, that next on Grape Encounters.
Nestled between world-class Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo wine countries, the warm and inviting city of Atascadero is the humble heart of the Central Coast. With access to endless wine country adventures, including wine and olive oil tasting tours, artisan farm experiences, food, wine, and cultural events, historic Atascadero's cozy and oh-so-friendly atmosphere make it the perfect home base for Central Coast tourists. Discover more about the heart of the Central Coast at visitatascadero.com. As the host of a wine show based on the Central Coast of California, a lot of visiting friends and listeners ask me for suggestions about places to visit in this neck of the woods. Well, one place that is always on that list is Hammersky Vineyard and Tasting Room, just 15 minutes northwest of Templeton on Vineyard Drive. From the beautiful New England barn to the charming historic farmhouse to the warm and inviting tasting room that sits on a knoll overlooking one of the region's most breathtaking views, Hammersky is a must-visit destination. Hammersky features an outstanding selection of handcrafted wines that are a true reflection of its rare and beautiful setting. Enchanting, sexy, sophisticated, but very approachable. See what I mean online at hammersky.com. Then plan a trip to one of the crown jewels of the Central Coast, Hammersky Vineyards. It deserves to be on your bucket list.
Imagine four fabulous days celebrating the delights of food and wine. That's Sunset Savor the Central Coast, coming to San Luis Obispo County. Sip more than 200 wines. Indulge in culinary bites from over 30 local chefs. Meet winemakers, brewmasters, and artisans. Discover the latest trends in food and wine from the experts at Sunset Magazine. Visit SavorCentralCoast.com. San Luis Obispo County. Pure playtime.
Your Savor the Central Coast adventure begins September 25th.
He's back, and he's not alone. Your Grape Encounter continues with David Wilson and a little help from his friends.
Looks like it's you and me, Mr. Merlot. I've got a glass and 7 hours to go.
And your Grape Encounter continues with David Wilson. And if you've been listening the past couple of months, you've probably noticed that there's been one guest that I've had on a number of times recently. And that's because I've been trying to get him addicted to being on the radio. He's Wilfred Wong. Wilfred Wong, the chief storyteller for wine.com. Absolutely my favorite place to buy wine. It's painless. Nobody leans over your shoulder and bugs you. You only get help if you want it. And I like that because sometimes I don't like people following me around the wine store. It drives me crazy. Anyway, great to have you. So you're going to be a regular contributor here to Grape Encounters Radio, and I'm excited about that. I love talking to you. Plus, I think you and I are very funny together.
We have a good time together.
You probably are one of the number one professional wine drinkers in the world. That is, people who get paid to drink wine. How do you get that job, by the way?
You know, you look it up in the wine desk one morning, and there you are.
It's a professional wine drinker, and you get to drink some really good wines, too.
Not bad.
But of course, this is a show for all people, right? So we talk about some really great wines, but talk about some, you know, regular wines as well. What wine, Wilfred, is on the mind of Wilfred Wong?
Well, Merlot, because I am feeling sorry for the grape.
Feeling sorry for the grape?
I think the grape is quite good. When in the right hands.
I, first of all, don't feel sorry for the grape.
That's okay.
The Merlot did take it in the shorts when the movie Sideways came out, and Rex Pickett, author of said movie, took a shot through his character Miles at Merlot and made Pinot Noir both the darling of Hollywood and the wine-drinking population, much to the dismay of those who were making Merlot, because Merlot, both literally and figuratively, died off the vine.
Well, I would say that many Merlot people deserve it because there's some Merlot out there that's not so good. In fact, a lot of Merlot is not so good. However, there are some wonderful Merlots out there that totally deserve attention.
Some Merlot people just deserve it?
Some of them should not make wine. Get them out of here.
They should not make wine in general. Sidebar for a second, Wilfred.
Yeah.
True or false, most wine is not good.
I would say false.
And reason for that?
I say that most wine is competently made, but boring.
So if wine is boring, it's not good.
Correct.
Yeah. And what happened with Merlot was they ripped out a lot of Merlot vineyards, right? And the
Correct.
People who were making great Merlot continued to make fantastic Merlot instead
Correct.
Because the pressure was on.
The people that make great Merlot continue to make great Merlot, but those were not the Merlot in question, as in the movie.
There weren't any particular Merlots in question in the movie Sideways.
That's true, too.
It was Merlot as a general category of wine. All Merlot sucks.
Correct.
Basically, according to Miles.
Yes.
But the thing is this, is that first of all, what was left was not wimpy Merlots, I think, but big Merlots that stand up very well next to a Cabernet Sauvignon. Would you agree? Merlot is not a wimpy grape.
No, it's not a wimpy grape at all. I would say that Merlot has so many different faces. I want to center my conversation today on high-class Merlot and why we should buy it.
Okay, take it away, Wilfred.
Well, in the Napa Valley, there are a number of outstanding Merlots. And the one that I am centering on right now is the Emelo. Emelo is the brainchild of the Wagner family grouping, famous for Camus Vineyards. So Chuck Wagner, who I've known for about 30-plus years, is the current president of the winery of the Wagner family group.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Correct. Yes, you can.
If you and Chuck Wagner are tight,
yeah,
then do you know the formula for Camus Conundrum?
No.
You don't?
He wouldn't tell me.
Have you ever asked him?
Yes.
You have?
And he said, I'm not telling you.
He's made a ton of money on that wine, right?
Well, Conundrum has been very popular, yes.
Why did the Wagner family split Conundrum off of the Camus label?
Oh, I think they just want to separate it from the brand. Camus is all about Cabernet in Rutherford. And Camus Conundrum, I don't really have the story on it, but my theory is that anything else that was not Cabernet, they want to spin off of Camus, so Camus would be standalone Camus Rutherford.
You can't tell me they're not making more money on Conundrum than Camus Cab.
I think they're doing well with Conundrum. I agree with you. So there's this winemaker, one of the children of Chuck Wagner, and named Jenny Wagner. Her mom, Cheryl. She is now the winemaker and proprietor of Emelo Vineyards in Napa Valley. and she makes only two wines. The current offering is the 2011 vintage, and it's pretty good. It's a tasty wine. It's got good fruit, and it's pure. It's a beautiful Merlot. It's 100% Merlot, and it's proud of the grape. It's not ashamed of being called Merlot.
It's not ashamed.
It's stand-up grape.
Okay, good.
Stand-up wine.
All right. Do you drink Merlot?
I do.
All right.
Often.
All right. There, I'll tell you what. This is going to cost you a little bit, but go pick up a bottle of the Carter Cellars Merlot. Mark Carter. He is one of only 14 winemakers in America to have made 100-point Cabernet. He makes one of those Merlots that makes you want to pound your chest and you'll immediately grow hair on it.
Oh, I like that. It's time that people look at the high-class Merlots as being special. And there are many besides Merlot, but Merlot is one that I do very much like.
Don't you think that for the most part that the low-class Merlots were pretty much weeded out?
Some of them were.
The survival of the fittest here, don't you think?
Well, what happened in the Merlot thing was when Merlot became hot, really super hot, everybody and their mother planted Merlot everywhere. And it was more of a greed thing. So all these growers planted Merlot. And when it got shot down, but many of them got eliminated.
They were getting $5,000 a ton for Merlot grapes in its heyday. And when the sideways effect really was in full swing, they were getting $1,500 a ton for the grapes.
As it should be.
What?
Because that Merlot was terrible.
Yeah, I'm just saying. But anyway, that was the impact of the movie. It's called The Sideways Effect, and marketing classes all over the world study the sideways effect.
Of course.
In the meantime, Merlot growers all over the world secretly express their hatred for Rex Pickett.
Nah. No, they love him.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you, Wilfred Wong from Wine.com. We'll talk more about America's favorite adult beverage when we come back together next week for another fabulous Grape Encounter. I'm David Wilson. Be sure to join our Grape Encounters radio group page on Facebook. Cheers.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Don't miss a single experience. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.